So actually, my name is Blake. My last name is Mike. And for what it's worth, you can reach me at blakem@world.std.com. But I'm not going to write that down in the hopes that you forget it. I have maybe 6 or 7 years of association with this class. I took it, same as you, quite a while ago, and then TA'd it for several years. And so I know a little bit about the subject matter, and I know a little bit about the course, but I've been sort of eyedroppered in here. So I don't know you guys. I don't know, you know, what David is, I know approximately what David has said to you so far and so on. So the best thing to do is to make this as interactive as possible, okay? So feel free to ask questions. If you can think of a question that our friends out there on the other end of the tape reel might have, ask those too. By all means, don't be shy, okay? Otherwise, I will just bore you to death by reading through these slides. So last time, I understand you looked at XQuery, which the main thing to note about XQuery, I think, is that it sort of doesn't exist, right? It's a real good idea. There's lots of parts of it that exist, but at least as far as I know, it's not fully baked. It uses the same data model as XPath. So if you've used XPath, you'll be comfortable with XQuery when it comes out. It's kind of a, I imagine you've come across this, but it's sort of a rough row to hoe. They've got two very different communities that they're trying to speak to. One of them is the community that thinks of XML documents that, you know, it's a document. It's about that big, and it, you know, and it doesn't change. Once you send somebody the document, they look at the document. Maybe they edit it or something like that, but it doesn't basically change. And then there's this other crowd that thinks that XML is a great way to store data. So you have vasty databases that change very quickly, okay? And that's and you store data in these XML databases, you know, these big DOMs, using XPath like expressions. So anyway, XQuery is a tough row to hoe. You've dealt with DTDs. If I were to spring a piece of XML on you, could you write me a DTD for it? Okay. Well, the good news is I won't do that. You're done with Project 3? Have you turned it in? Phew. Right? Okay. So you could build a DTD for this, right? You could fill in this area right here. Tell me one thing that goes there. Just one thing.
I'm not looking at the slides, so tell the people away where there is.
I thought I pointed it right. Can you see the?
I won't be looking.
I see. Okay. Right.
So you just have to verbalize.
I'm sorry. So what's the, okay, so let's talk about what's the first thing that goes in this doc type declaration.
You want to declare like the
entities. Yeah, which one do you have to declare first?
I guess you start with bookstore.
Yeah, bookstore is already there.
So it's starting with element
book. Yes, just so. So did you run up against any of the problems with DTDs? What don't you like about DTDs? What do you wish you could do with DTDs that you can't?
You can validate against your declarations and it's easy to validate against your
Sure, sure. It's really, so DTDs are, okay, so let's see. So one of the first things that I think about XML is if anybody uses XML, the acronym XML, in a sentence, and you can't replace it with comma-separated text without laughing, you should think twice, okay? XML doesn't say a whole lot about format. It really doesn't say much at all, okay? What it gives you is kind of a nested structure, right? You could say this is a child of that. It gives you a little bit of nesting. It gives you some typing information and so on. But it really doesn't say a whole lot, okay? If you want to start talking about what you're about, if you want to start saying specific things like this is a number, or this is character string, or something like that, you have to have some kind of data typing mechanism. So DTD is the first one that came along. So, as you say, it's essential because it does two things. One is I can hand you the DTD, and that's documentation of what you better give me. Not only that, but exactly, and this is important, exactly that same DTD I'm going to use to validate your data when it comes to me. Right? So it's both the documentation, that is, you can read it, both you, the human being, and you, the computers that are at your behest, can read it, and I can use it to validate your document. We are using exactly the same thing, right? That's kind of important, because we don't have to worry about synchronization problems, right? But what can't you, can you think of a couple of things that you would love to do with a DTD that you can't? Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, so...
Sorry to interrupt, but one more thing.
Yeah.
If you could paraphrase any comments or questions that our students have.
Righto. Which one was it? So if you look right here, so what you said was that you can't put the XML into an XML... You can't put the DTD into an XML parser. And that's essentially true. You couldn't take a DTD, a naked DTD, and hand it to an XML parser. You can, however, put it in there. And the XML parser better handle it. Okay? What other things are problematic? Yeah?
You can't do anything with names and namespaces.
Right, so you can't do anything with names and namespaces. DTDs don't... Well, as a matter of fact... Yeah, DTDs have absolutely no idea what a namespace is. No clue. Can't do anything about namespaces. Okay? But I can think of a lot of other things you can't do. You can't say this is a date. With a DTD, there's no way to say this is a date. There's no way with a DTD to say this is a number between 1 and 10. Okay? There's no way with a DTD to say this is a character string whose maximum length is 32 characters. There's no way with a DTD even, and this is, I believe you've already come across this, there's no way with a DTD to say this item, this, for instance, attribute, is a reference to something else in this document. Right? If it's not somewhere else in this document, it can't be here. Right. For instance, did you do a project that involved a video library, videotape library, or something like that? And in that library, there were DVDs or something like that, movies, one way or the other, and references from those movies to the members of the cast. Right. So it would be illegal in that document to have a reference from one of those movies to a cast member that wasn't in the document. There's no way to say that with a DTD. Okay? So, bring on XML schema. So, as we were just saying, people recognized pretty early on that DTDs just weren't going to cut it. they have sort of a pleasant mathematical syntax that you can prove nice things about and so on, but it turns out to be just completely insufficient for doing most of the things that you need to do in real sort of, pardon me, business situations, defining data types, defining data interchange types. So you've met the W3C, right? They own this whole thing, right? So they decided to invent schema. And have you all heard of the second system phenomenon? The second system phenomenon is where you do the first one, you do the first implementation of some spec, and you realize that, boy, you just really didn't understand the problem, right? You just didn't get it. So you start working on the second one. And 10 years later, you know, your lofty ideas are still, you still haven't finished implementing them all. It happens all the time, right? That everybody realizes all the little things that they should have put into the first one, and each one of them wants to add that little thing and two others to the second one, and it just never gets done. Schema had a problem like that. It took Schema forever to become a recommendation. The second thing is that, as you will soon see, there's a trade-off. In order to do all of the things that DTD can't do, Schema can do most of those things. Most of the things I described a minute ago, Schema can do quite handily. On the other hand, Schema is so unbelievably complicated that it will take you a long time to feel comfortable with it. So W3C, when they published instead of XML, which is this nifty short little document, right? What is it? 4 pages? 3 pages? Something like that? It's 3 separate documents. Okay, there's a primer, which just sort of, it's just trying to say, look, this is how this system works. This is what this is all about. Structures is the composition of the language, the semantics of the language, and the data types I'm going to, many times this evening, I'm going to make analogies to Java. Will that work for you all? You all pretty comfortable with Java? Okay. So the data types describes the things that are the analogs in schema of int and long and char. Okay? The root data types. Unfortunately, you'll find out that there are about 87 of them. Okay. What are we going to do? Okay, so here's po.xml. XSD, I guess. So there are some things to notice here. First of all, notice that the XML instance points to schema. So all of this stuff is in the namespace schema. That is to say, schema itself has a schema. Okay, so there is a schema for schema. Let's just walk through this thing. It's a pretty simple one. Annotation is just what it looks like. Annotation is just room for you to say whatever you want. The parser just throws it away. Here's a definition of an element. The element is a purchase order. and its type is purchase order. So this is the name that you'll see in the document. This is the definition within the schema of the type of the element purchase order. And for instance, you can see here's the definition of that type. Is there anything else that... Sure. We can have a look here. Here's a built-in type. Remember I said the equivalent of Java, int, or long, or something like that? This is a built-in type. And you can recognize it because it begins with XSD colon. It's in the XSD namespace. Okay? I'm glossing blithely over namespaces for the minute. We'll get back. They actually are something I will talk about later on. Okay? I will come back to them. But that's a primitive type. Here's another primitive type. Here's another one. All of those things are primitive types. But you notice it says here it just says type equals. And then this thing is of a primitive type. Up here, we did the same thing. And we used a type that we defined. Okay, so this is not a primitive type. This is a type that's defined in this file. And as I said, here's the definition right here. XSD allows you to define two kinds of objects. It has two kinds of type definitions, which I think there are those that argue that this is a mistake. But here's a simple type. Okay? And there's a handful of rules that you have to remember about whether something can be a simple type or it needs to be a complex type. Essentially, if the element has a name and only a name and contains text or nothing, right? That is to say, it's not mixed, or it doesn't have children. No, it can have children that are elements. So if it's got, it can't be mixed. But if it doesn't have attributes, it can be a simple type. Otherwise, it needs to be complex, as these guys are. All right? As I say, that seems kind of inelegant. All right? It means that there's something squirrely about that. I mean, you have to use a different syntax to describe something that's complicated than you do to describe something that's simple. There's this kind of it's not like you put a little more in and you get a little more out. At some point you keep putting a little more in, you put a little more in, you put a little more. At some point you have to stop. Go all the way back to the beginning, try something else, and then you can start out again. It seems a little clumsy. But there you go. Okay, so we've probably already talked about this a bit. The reason we want schema is mostly for data validation. It's also for documentation. So data validation means that when you send me a document, I don't have to get my big, you know, my big service out and start running it against my search engine or something like that. I don't have to get this huge thing out and start running your data through it to figure out that your data is a mess, right? I have some trivial way of just checking the data to see whether it follows the basic rules that I've laid out for what the data has to look like. It might even be part of a contract between a provider and a customer, or between two businesses that are partnering on some deal. The XSD might be part of that contract. But certainly, You know, I'm going to, it's, as I said, it's essential that it be a single thing that we both use. I hand you a copy of the XSD. I use the same XSD to validate. Right? The other thing that you can use this for is to set default. You saw this with DTDs, that you can use it to set default values. You can use it so that to say, if this thing isn't specified, if this, for instance, attribute for this kind of element isn't specified, the default value is thus and so. That can be part of the schema. You could do that with DTD as well. I admit to having no idea of what the comment about storage of application information means. Got me there. So, here's an example of exactly what we were talking about. Right. This is incomplete, isn't it? Where's the attribute? There it is. There it is. I'm sorry. So here's the specification of a date. In fact, it turns out that certain kinds of dates are a base type. Right? Darn it. Sorry. Certain kinds of dates are just a base type part of schema. It turns out that many of the dates that you'll probably want to use are not include. So xsd:\date includes several formats for dates, but probably not the ones that you'll want. Right? As you can imagine, you know, if you want to use something at all tricky, it's probably not there. As I say, it'll handle a couple of formats, I believe. I believe that you can replace those dashes with slashes and it'll still work. I don't remember what the details are, but it'll handle a couple of formats, but not all of them. Okay, so now we get into a discussion of how schema works. So schema has... I found this a problem. Let's put it that way. I found this difficult to understand when I first started reading schema. There were two things going on, two entirely different things being defined in a schema document. One of them is elements in the document over there. Okay? Elements in the document to which you refer. Elements of the document that you will validate eventually. That's one of the two things that's in the document. The other thing is definitions of types that are used within this document itself. Okay? Let's have a look at that. So here, this... Doggone it. This product type right here, that's a reference... That's the reference to a definition that's inside this document. Okay? In fact, here's the definition right there. Okay? Right. So that says that this type, this reference to product type right here, is a reference to this definition right here of product type. Okay? So that's a reference to something that is defined within this file, a type. Okay. On the other hand, this word product right here is the name of an element. Nothing named product will ever appear in this file. What you are defining here, you're saying that in the other document, in the XML document that I'm validating, there's a thing called, there's an element. You will encounter an element called product. And here's what it looks like. Here's its type. Okay? I found those things too hard to keep separate in my head. I was constantly confusing. You'll see when you go to define them, there's one set of verbs that you use to define one thing and one set of verbs that you use to define the other. And personally, I found those hard to keep separate in my head. If you think of it that way, yeah. Right. Is this actually going backwards? It might be. Yes. Okay. So the question was, where do you define the root element?
No.
And the root element is... I admit to being rusty on this. I will try to tell you when I'm not sure. And unfortunately, it will probably be several times this evening. But I believe that the root element is the first element that you define in the schema. Okay? The top one. Now, as I say, in a properly constructed schema, there will be lots of types. There may well be lots of types defined before any elements are defined. Okay? And if that happens, it's sort of a rude thing for a schema author to do. It would be it's very nice if the schema author simply puts that first element as the first line of the schema. It makes it clear, easy to understand. But if you get somebody who prefers to define all their types and then start defining the elements, you may have to read several pages before you get to find out what the root element is. Okay? In fact, the order of things in the XSD is completely irrelevant. Right? You can put things in any order you want. That's just like any other sort of reasonable programming language. The order just doesn't make any difference. Okay. Global components are things that are defined at the top level. This is another way to divide up the parts of your schema. There are global things, just the way in any reasonably constructed Java program, you have multiple scopes. Okay, you have the scope of the class, and then maybe the scope of one of the methods in the class. And you might even have a nested class, right? If you have a nested class, then the nested class can see everything outside, but nobody outside can see things inside, and so on, right? Same deal, okay? Same deal here. Whoops. Do we have a nested type here? Nope. No nested types. So the global components are the things that are defined at the top level. And local components are things that are defined inside the scope of some other definition. Now, let me just say, if there were somebody else standing here, There are some things that just are true about schema, okay? And there are some things that are my opinions of schema, okay? And naturally, since they're mine, I think they amount to good taste, okay? So it's my opinion that good taste in schema suggests that you probably want to make almost all of your... You want to have a very good reason for not making a definition global. Okay? My suggestion is that any time you define a type, you make that type global. My suggestion is that you just never, ever define a local type. Now, you'll see that there are some times that that just doesn't make any sense. And when that's the case, by all means, ignore this. But my suggestion is that you start out by making everything global. Every time you define a new type, just put it at the top level and reuse it. That's the reason. The reason is that you can then reuse it. Right? It's the same deal as making a method or something, making a class public as opposed to making it packaged or something like that. You make it so that you can reuse it. Yeah.
In what sense do you mean that it's at the top level?
Yeah, right. I was hoping there was an example. Here we go. Okay. Here's the nested type. So this defines the complex type items. Okay? One of the things that happens, where is that going to be used?
Would you mind highlighting instead of using that?
Not at all. I think that'll work. So this is a complex type called items, right? Among the things that is part of items, you'll notice that this element here, so we'll come across this, we'll probably talk about this in more detail in a moment, but you can imagine what sequence means, right? Sequence is exactly the same as in DTD, open, A, B, C, D, close, right? Not A or B or C, but A, B, C. I guess it's comma, right? So it says these things occur in this order, okay? So it says that items is a sequence of elements. The first one is an element. The first element in this sequence occurs at minimum 0 and at maximum lots of times. And you notice there's no type equals here? This is the first time we've seen something that doesn't say type equals. And the reason is because its type is given here. Where's the end? Right there. That's its type. Okay? Instead of saying type equals, we nested its type. That's a local type. There's no way for anything else in the world, nothing else in this document can have exactly that type. Okay? That is to say, if you decide to change the type of this element, the element named item, okay, if you decide to change the type of that item, you will change it here. Right? You'll change it somewhere in that text right there. And if somebody else has a similar definition, they're SOL. Right? Does that make sense? So this is exactly the same deal as why you don't use cut and paste to reuse code, right? It's because when the next guy thinks of a better way to do it or has to add some new feature, they have to add it in two places, right? So if we define this here, then when we decide to change it and somebody else uses it too, they're SOL. Okay? So is that clear the difference between the global and the local scope now? Yeah. So, right. So, as you know, the two main parts of XML are elements and attributes, and that's what schema is all about. Is it's going to allow you to type? Oh, sorry about that. It's going to allow you to define the types of both the elements and the attributes. Now, one of the nice things is that you actually can use the same data types to define the types of the attributes and the types of the elements, right? That only makes sense if this is an element whose contents, let's see, surely you've come across this argument already that the distinction between a nested element and an attribute is a little bit fuzzy, right? It's unclear sometimes. There are any number of reasons for choosing to use an attribute instead of a nested element or vice versa. Even if two people were asked to produce XML descriptions of the same domain, one of them might choose to model something as an attribute, and the other might choose to model that exact same thing as a nested element. Well, the same thing goes here. If there is an attribute whose contents is a date, and an element whose contents is a date, it makes sense that they can have the same type. Okay. Now, obviously, attributes can't have nested elements, right? So there are some things you can't do. Okay, here we come. This is the first of the sort of significant complexities. Elements with simple types don't have any child elements or any attributes. That is, they contain no XML structures. They're strings or numbers or something like that. Dates, what have you. Complex types contain nested elements or they contain attributes. They describe XML structures. And all of a sudden, I realize why they have to do that. I still think it's tacky. Okay, named versus anonymous types. Global names have to have names. Global types have to have names. Otherwise, there's no way to use them. All right? But as we saw back here, here's a nested type. And it doesn't need a name because it applies to this element, right? It could have a name, and if it did have a name, it could be referred to within the context of that sequence. So you could have item A and item B, both of which had the type whatever the name of that thing. So you could call this thing, you would say complex type, I guess it's name, yeah. Say complex type. Oops, I'm sorry. So anyway, right here, you would say complex type name equals nested type or nested item or something like that. And then you could use it inside this context, but not outside. Does that make sense? That's somewhat in conflict with something I said earlier. It's not the case that because this type is nested, because it's a local type, you can only use it in one place. It is merely true that you can only use it within its scope. Does that make sense? All right, so if you have a variable inside an inner class in Java, you can use it throughout that inner class. You can use it anywhere you want to in that inner class. You just can't use it in any other inner class, right? Or if you have a package level variable in Java, you can use it anywhere in that package. You just can't use it in any other package, right? And if you have a public, but if you have a public variable, you can use it anywhere. If you have a top-level public variable, top-level public class, that is a class whose name is, a class that's not nested anywhere, you can see it from anywhere. Okay, so the deal is that these inner, these local declarations can be used anywhere in scope, just not outside of that scope. And as I say, my suggestion is how often do you use nested classes in Java? What percentage of your classes in Java are nested? I bet it's something under 20, right? Maybe under 10. If you're doing UIs, maybe higher than that, but it's typically pretty small. And I suggest you keep the same kind of ratio here. Put most of your stuff at the top level. Oops. Okay. So, the way you define a new type in schema is either by restriction or extension. That is, you say, this type is built up of some of that type and some of that type. That's extension. So you say, this type is a sequence of this, of one of these, one of those, and one of the other, right? That's extension. Or by restriction, you say this is a string, but it's at most 32 characters long. Or this is a string, but it's all uppercase.
Or vice versa, you can have a simple type extended and it becomes a complex type?
So you certainly can have complex types that are built up out of simple types. Once something is complex, I'm not positive about this, but I'm reasonably sure that there's no way to get it to be simple again once it's complex. So, yeah, you can. So, the mechanisms are basically anything. Most of the things that you can do with a simple type, leave it simple. If you start bolting simple types together, you might get you probably get one that's complex. Once it's complex, it's complex. There's not much you can do to say unbolt those two guys. So, once again, I hope this works. I believe that you have all seen Java before, that you're all pretty familiar and comfortable with Java, so I'm going to continue to make analogies to Java. Any place that you can pass any method that takes an object as an argument, you can pass anything that's a subtype of object, that is to say, practically anything, to it. If you have a string, right, anything that's a... Strings are final, never mind. What's a good one? A map, okay, a hash map. You can subtype a hash map. If you subtype a hash map, any method that takes as its argument a hash map, you can pass in your subtype. That's what subtyping is all about, right? So the same is true in schema. If something expects a specific type and you have a subtype of that thing, a restriction of that thing, you can use it instead. Right? So if there's some place that expects a a date, and you have a date in 2006 type, which is based on date, but restricted to dates in the year 2006, any place that you can use a date, you can also use a date 2006. Okay? Okay. Here are some built-in data types. God knows you don't want to try and remember these. Eventually they'll probably, you know, haunt your dreams and stuff like that. But I wouldn't set out to memorize them. They'll come to you entirely soon enough. Yeah.
How many of these are useful?
So the question is, how many of these are useful? So almost all of them are useful to somebody. Okay? So there are lots of business-to-business standards that are defined in schema. And they are like, you know, they are the Bible to some group of, you know, some small corner of the financial world or somebody who's, you know, publishing books or something like that. And they care a lot about, you know, 5 or 10 of these, right? And somebody else who's doing something else cares a whole lot about a completely disjoint set of 5 or 10 of them, right? Very few people care about all of them. Very, very few. Many of these things mean just what they used to mean. You know, I can't select this, so I'm going to have to point at it.
And just so you know, I'm instructed not to look at it, so you just be verbal about
it. All right. Okay. So entities, entity, ID ref, I believe that, or NM token, you saw those in DTD land, right? Yeah. ID is what the reference to the the references to the members of the cast. The references to the members of the cast in the for the movies, those were IDs, right? It's a reference to something that's somewhere else in the document. NM token, I think, is a string that's restricted to a certain set of characters, like it can't have a space in it and stuff like that, right? All the rest of them, you know, they mean more or less what you expect them to mean. The only warning that I'll give you is that before you go off and define your own type, have a look at these things. Paw through them once or twice, because it's quite likely that much of what you want is already there. It's not like Java, where there are only, you know, 6 base types plus object. Here there's a page full of them, okay? Complex types. So complex types, so they are, you know, they are just what you'd expect. The simple, so simple is going to be things that are not elements, strings, essentially strings of characters. Okay, elements are simple elements. Mixed are things that are character data and elements, and empty is pretty obvious. The sequence choice and all correspond quite exactly to their analogs in DTD. The sequence says this first you see this type, an element of this type. First you see a thing, an entity, I'll call it, an entity of this type. Then you see an entity of that type. And next you see an entity of the other type. Right? They're always in that order. Okay, choice says, next you'll see one of these things. Right? All says, you'll see all of these. I don't believe it says any order. Right, yes, in any order. It says they will all occur before this is all over. Okay, before this is all done, you'll see every one of these things. But we're not saying at what time you'll see which one. Right? So I think now is probably a good time to take a break. Let's go get a can of Red Bull and take a deep breath of air and come back and try to wade through the rest of this. See you in a minute. Okay, so here comes namespaces. Namespaces are tricky. Namespaces are very tricky. It wouldn't take you too much to stump me about them. But I'll tell you what I know. Their need is obvious. It's the same reason that you use packages in Java. Okay? It's because you want something called that in this local context, it's called stack. Right? You want a type called stack because that's what it is. It's the stack, right? And you're going to have one in the network software and one in the UI software. And you don't want their names colliding, right? The UI stack and the network stack. Makes perfect sense. That's what namespaces are for. They just keep your world separate from anybody else's world. So if you think about it, if you really want to do that, how are you going to make sure that your namespace is different than anyone else's? Well, you're probably going to have to make it about half a mile long, right? You're going to have to say, Blake, Mike's really and truly special. Only I use this namespace for the year 2006, I'm pretty sure. Okay? I mean, that's going to have to be your namespace because otherwise, when you change your mind, I mean, even when I've participated in this class from year to year, I've run into namespace collisions across various versions of my programs, okay? Because I called them edu.harvard.cscie259.po, and I forgot to put in the 2004, right? So when I did it again in 2005, I had a namespace collision, right? So what you got to do is you've got to make this big, honking namespace name, right? Well, the problem with that is it's a big, honking namespace name, and you don't want to use it all the time. So they've come up with this nifty way of helping you get around that. Let's see, am I allowed to tell you that on this page, or do I have to wait a second? Right, so the namespace is bound by a URI. Now, a URI is like a URL. You can't tell the difference, really, when you look at them. But a URL is necessarily something that you can reach out and touch across the network, okay? A URI, that's not the case with a URI. A URI is a character string that follows a certain set of rules and is unique, okay? It has nothing to do with a web address. It might happen to be a web address. In fact, one great way for me to generate a URI is to take my website, put a file on it, right, and make the URL for that file into a call that a URI. It's pretty sure that whenever I hand that URI out, it's unique because nobody else has my domain name. Nobody else, and as long as I'm pretty careful to create new directories and stuff like that, it means that those are pretty good, pretty well unique. right? But that's not the only way to construct a URI. There are lots of other ways. All right? So a namespace is determined by a URI, and as I say, a URI is just one great honking long string that's pretty likely to be unique. All right? For instance, here's one. Ah, doggone it. This place, in the head of this document, there's actually a tricky bit here. It says, where it says, it defines the namespace prod, and it says that the namespace prod is equivalent to HTTP colon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And notice that it uses it in the element that defines it. That's kind of cool, right? So it says prod colon product out there on the left, and then it defines what prod colon means in that first XMLNS definition, that first attribute. That's a little bit on the tricky side, a little bit sly, right? It uses it before it defines it. But what that XMLNS attribute does is it says from now on, when you say, you parser, when you see prod, just imagine that I said http://example.org/prod. Okay? So like I said, the way you define a namespace is with this great wonking string that's really, really long, so it's likely to be unique, and it's way too long to use it very much. You don't want to write it down every time. So this is the mechanism that allows you not to write it down every time. Okay? So it's well to get used to this, to the idea that this is just sort of a text replace. This is just sort of a macro. Okay? Every place that you see prod colon, you could expand it into http://, et cetera. All right? So, also, because it's text replace, because it's a macro, and because it's treated like a macro, and that macro is defined in the document only, in this document, you can use any definition you want. So in my document, I can say XMLNS colon P equals all the rest of that. And in your document, you can say XMLNS colon prod equals whatever. And we've defined the same namespace. Locally, my namespace is P, and locally yours is prod, but it's in fact the same namespace. Okay, so this is just an example of what I was talking about a minute ago. There are two numbers defined here? Yeah. So in the first line, we define a namespace whose local name is ord. And in the second line, we define a namespace whose local name is prod. And then later in the document, we have an ord number. And past that, so line six or so, we have prod number. And you'll notice that ord number is likely to be defined quite differently than prod number. Ord number certainly contains alpha characters, and there's no reason to guess that prod number does. Okay? So their definitions might be quite different. Does that make sense? Do you see where this is going? See what the point is? See why you'd want to do this and all? I can barely hear your heads rattle, so you're not shaking loud enough. Okay, so that's the deal. So you remember that I said that schema had a schema? Well, it turns out schema's schema defines XMLNS. So, if you look at the first line there, if you look at ORD there, you'll see that that definition contains no name. Whereas the one below it says XMLNS colon prod, that one just says XMLNS. What that's doing is defining the empty namespace. That is the default namespace. The namespace that elements are in, if you don't say, they're in some namespace. So any element that doesn't begin with, you know, blah, 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 colon, is in the default namespace. That is to say, anything in this document that, for instance, at line 4, items there, is in the default namespace. And what's the default namespace? http://example.org/ord. Right? This is handy. This is really handy. You all have worked with XPath a bunch now, right? Okay. Did you get just freaking sick and tired of writing XSL colon? Okay, so if it were worth your time, if there were fewer of your elements in there than there were XSL elements, you could have defined XSL to be the default namespace, and then you could have left that off. Or at the very least, you could have defined it to be X colon to save you some typing, right? And to make life just incredibly miserable for your grader. So within a schema, you can only define one namespace, though. Each schema applies to some namespace, not any other namespace. It defines the behavior of that namespace. That makes sense, right? The whole point of this is, like packages, you can't say this class is partly in this package and partly in that package. Say this class is in this package, and then you use it from some other package, right? Yeah.
It makes sense as long as you can combine different schemas to
sure.
type a single document.
Sure. Sure. For instance, I keep going to do that. For instance, you've already seen a case in which you used types from XSD. Let's see, every schema document will use types that are native, that are base types from XSD, and combine them to make your own new types, right? All of the base types live in the namespace XSD, whatever XSD is turns out to be, okay? And you use them to define your own types. We've done that several times so far. So XSD colon string is a type that's defined in the namespace whatever XSD means, right? So you've seen cases where we used things from other packages to define things in this package, right? And at the very worst, you can say, you know, define a new type, which is that type, right? My type string, you know, my string is XSD colon string.
What is the target namespace again?
So at line 3, it says what the target namespace is. In this particular case, it's http://xml.org/prod.
What is
So what I'm doing is I'm defining the data types in the namespace, http://, all of that stuff. I'm defining the types in, oh boy. Okay. So let's back up a second. Let's try it with a Java analogy. So you know that in java.util, there's a type called hashMap, right? Okay, so if I wanted to write my own hashMap, I would call it, you know, net.blake.hashMap, right? And the way I do that is I'd say, okay, I'm talking about the package net.blake, and here's the type hashMap inside that. Okay? And that type, net.blake.hashMap, is distinct from java.util.hashMap. Nobody's going to confuse them because this one's net.blake, that one's java.util. Okay? So the definition target not namespace says is analogous to saying java.util or net.blake. It says, this is the namespace I'm talking about, and I'm about to define some types. All right? I can see that didn't work.
So is the target namespace kind of like the default namespace?
So the point of a schema, just as when you write Java code, what you're doing is you're defining types. You're defining data with behavior, right? Okay, so you write a class. For instance, the example I was using is let's stick with HashMap. So we've got this data type, and it's HashMap. And a HashMap has certain characteristics. Okay, it takes linear time to get things out and stuff like that. All right. That class HashMap is the definition of a type. XSD, XML schema, does the same thing. It defines data types. It defines data types in XML. Whereas Java defines data types in Java, XSD defines data types in XML. All that namespace does is it has the analogous behavior to saying what package you're in. You say, I'm going to be in package http://, and I'm defining the type, product type, right? So this says that it's defining a type whose fully qualified name, just as the fully qualified name of Java's HashMap is java.util.hashMap, the fully qualified name of this complex type at line 4 there is http://example.org/prod product:product type. That's its fully qualified name. Now, if you were in some other XSD, if you were in some other schema document, you might easily say xmlns:org equals http://example, et cetera, right? So what that does is it says, inside this document, I'm going to use org to mean the namespace, that thing. And then when you said org:product type, we'd know just what you were talking about. Right? Has that got it?
I was just wondering why, if you have the example.org/prod is both the default namespace and the target namespace.
Yes. Okay, so the question is, in this document, there's on line 2, it says that the default namespace in this document is that string, the HTTP thing, and the target namespace is also that string. Well, now that's kind of handy, right? Because otherwise, you'd have to say, I'm defining org:product type, right? So if the default namespace, for instance, were http://blake.com, right, then when I got down here at line 4 to define product.type, I'd better have some way to talk about the namespace http://example, because if I don't put any prefix on it, it's in blake.com or blake.net or whatever I said a minute ago. So the default namespace is whatever I said the default namespace is. If I took that line out, let's not talk about what happens if I take the line out. But okay. And once again, to use an analogy, there's nothing. I can't think of anything quite analogous in Java. Can't think of anything.
So, are there situations where you want the default namespace to be different than the target namespace?
Sure. Imagine that you got really tired of typing XSD. Okay, you were sick of typing XSD, and you were only defining two types. But you had to type XSD a million times. You might easily want to make XSD the default namespace. But then on that line 4 where you would define product type, you'd have to define the namespace, say, org, to be http://, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you'd have to say XSD:complex-type name equals org, product type, because otherwise your default namespace is XSD. So when you define product type and it isn't prefixed with anything that ends in colon, it says you're defining something in the namespace XSD. Right? So typically those two things will be the same. Typically you want the things that you're defining to be the same as the target. You want your target namespace to be the same as your default namespace. It makes your document easier to read. That's tricky. Does everybody see where that went? Does everybody see why that was tricky, how it ended up?
I'm not so sure. So why do we bother having the target namespace if it's going to be the same as the default namespace?
Because it might not be. It usually is, but it might not be. The question is why do you have to say both? Okay, so the analogous situation is Java, where when you say this thing is in package blake.net, you are defining things in blake.net, and if you use something, it's also in blake.net. So if you define a class named, foo, and there's another thing in the package, and its name is bar, and it says, make me a foo, you're in the same package. It all works out. Okay? What this is saying is that there are essentially two things. There's the namespace that you're in as you create the thing, and there's the namespace that you're defining. So it's as if there were two different packages. It's as if you were allowed to say, as if you were allowed to sit in the package java.util, as if you were allowed to write code in the package java.util, which defined the package blake.net. You can't do that in Java, but you can here. And I think it's fair to say that they didn't design it with that in mind. That wasn't a goal. That's a side effect. It's a side effect of the fact that those things are basically text substitutions. Okay, it's just text substitution. In Java, you are in some sense in the package when you start defining things. In the most common behavior, you're actually creating a file that's two layers down in some directory. When you do schema, there's no such thing as putting things, in some directory. You simply say what the name of the namespace that you're using is, and you can make it anywhere, right? You can also say what the output namespace is, okay? Because it could be anywhere. And as I say, I don't think that they designed it to allow that. I believe that that works out because they designed it to allow both of those things. Okay? Well, that horse is beaten to death. So, what we've seen is four different ways to do this. I've seen the first one. I hasten to admit that I don't remember what those two things do. Fortunately, that's what Google is for. Okay. We've seen their behaviors, though. The behavior is, right. No, I do know a little bit about what they do. Okay, so those things say where the schema is. Do we have an example of this? No. They tell where to find the schema. Yeah, they tell those give the locations of the schema documents. Okay. So we saw that you'll remember the DTDs say where. That the DTD is essentially part of the document. It's part of the XML document. It's the doc type element, weird element, okay? And that there's a kind of a nifty way that you can say, by the way, this doc type isn't really here. It's over in that file over there. Well, and that's built into the syntax of XML. Right, there's that. It's a funny element. It's not a normally behaved element, right? I think it's got a bang in front of it or something like that. Okay. So, this is similar. This is a way within schema to say a way within an XML document to give the location of the XSD. So, for instance. This should have one. Yes. Okay. So that fella right there says that for all of the elements in this document whose name does not begin with something that ends in a colon, okay, that is to say that they don't have a namespace, the definition of the types of those elements is given in the file that can be found at po.xsd. Right? Similarly, that's this one. That's no namespace schema location. XSI schema location works the same way as XMLNS does. Okay? It gives the name you will use it to give the name of to give the abbreviation for some namespace, and then you'll tell it where the document is that defines that namespace.
Is it almost like for you?
Yes.
Top of that other file?
Yes. It's very, very, functionally, it's very like that.
Because when you assign the namespace to the string to the URL,
No, there does. There does have to be a file there. So, No. So, right. Yep, good point. So the question is, basically, huh? How does this work? And the answer is that here it says XSI. Okay, so this is giving the location of a file. It is not defining a namespace. Namespaces, as I said, all that verboseness that I gave about wonking big strings applies to namespaces. Okay? This is not defining or using a namespace. It's simply saying that document over there defines a namespace. This document uses those definitions. Yeah?
And the namespace that's given in...
Okay. All right, so the issue of what namespace is defined in the document that is referenced here never comes up. What target namespace it used? Don't know, don't care. Locally, I'm saying it's the null namespace. If I were to say XSI colon schema location, I still wouldn't care what the namespace that the schema defined. I would simply be saying locally, I'm going to refer to whatever namespace that guy defines as foo. Okay? Do you see how that works? You don't have to know what it is. You're just saying over here I'm going to call it foo. I don't need to know what it is. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, what can I say about that? It's a level of indirection. So, okay. So think of this. Suppose I want to let you into my house. Okay? My house has a lock on the door. Okay? Between the two of us, I can say, I'm going to give you the, and you can get into my house. All right? It might be a combination. It might be a set of numbers. I might give you the combination to a combination lock, right? Or more likely, I'll hand you a key. Okay? I could also hand you a big hammer, okay? There are any number of things I could give you to get you into my house, right? But the transaction is clear. I'm going to hand you something that you're going to use to get into my house, right? This works the same way. You don't have to know what namespace this file defines. It defines a bunch of types, okay? They happen to be defined in a namespace, and the reason is that if it ever becomes important that you have to tell that one, this one from that one, you can do it, right? So there has to be some way to make that unique so that you can refer to it, yeah?
Presented us several ways to have to define namespaces.
Yep.
Is there an advantage to one to the other? It sounds like this one where you're using someone else's namespace probably is the easiest way to go because you don't have to really
Right.
You know, you have that file, you know where it's located.
So don't get confused here. Sorry, too late. Let's all go out and come back in. So the issue is relating instances to schemas, okay? In order to do that, there are a couple of things you have to do. First, you have to create the namespace. First of all, you have to define the types in the namespace, okay? You have to define these types. That's issue one. Then sort of as a kind of an obnoxious obnoxious bit of bookkeeping, you have to distinguish this namespace, this set of type definitions, from every other set of type definitions, past, present, or future, in this universe. That's assigning it a namespace. Okay, so that's two separate things. Then there's a third thing, which is that when you use an XML document, you have to refer to one of those type definitions to say, that thing over there describes the types in this document. Validate this document against those types. Now, there are a bunch of ways to do that. You could say, use this fully described namespace wherever the heck you can find it. And you'll see that is one thing that you can do. That's possible. Much more likely is you can say, the definitions are in that file over there, whatever namespace it is. You know, it's unique, that's fine, I don't care, I know which file I'm talking about, it's that one. So there are two sides to this. The XMLNS stuff is what you use to refer to a namespace from within the document, from within the XSD. The XSI stuff is what you use to refer to an XSD from an XML document. Right? The XMLNS stuff is what you use to refer to a namespace from an XML document. Yeah, almost. If you do it a little bit, so part of the reason that this is hard is because I'm, you know, standing in the front of this room blowing a lot of hot air. When you have to do it, I think that you'll see what happens. It won't be so hard when you actually have to push these things together. From one side, you're pointing at something. Okay, so from XML, you need to point at two different things. You need to point at definitions of types and definitions of namespaces. Right? You need to say validate against this, and you need to say this is of that type. And those are two different things that you can say. From the XSD, you need to be able to say the same thing you said in the first case on the other side, which is, here's a type, and I refer to it by its namespace definition. And the other thing you need to do is you need to say, I'm defining this type. So that's four things, two on each side, and one of them happens to be the same on both sides. Right? Boy, that was deft. Schema processors, there's a bunch of them. I'll show you one in a minute. What up?
Just wondering about relating. You talked about relating instances to schemas to essentially invoke a schema from an instance. Can you do that? Do you do that from another schema as well?
Yes, absolutely. So we can see places where that happens. So. Okay, here's a case where we refer to schemas, two of them, two schemas from within a document, an instance, an XML instance. Okay, there's a reference to prod, to HTTP, et cetera, prod, and a reference to HTTP .org. Okay, we use one of them. We define one of them as the null namespace and the other one as prod. So this document refers to two different sets of type definitions. Okay, it refers to the type number, and it refers to two different types number. Okay, refers to those types implicitly, because the element number, the element prod colon number, has a type. When it's my business to validate this document, I have to go somewhere and say, what's a prod number? Okay, I see. It's a bunch of digits. Cool. This is good. Then I have to say, how do I validate number? Okay, it's a string of uppercase characters and numbers. Oh, this one looks good. We're all set.
But you can't find that out given the information that's just out there.
That's right. You have to find the XSD.
Right,
so this is, that's what I mean about once you start doing this, it'll start to make more sense. The definitions of those types are not here. So how do you get the definitions of those types? Well, you do it like this. Now that says, by the way, the definition for the schema, the definition for the types, it's right there. Okay? Actually, yeah. Okay, so that tells you where the schema is. Then, so this is an XML document which has the same rules as every other XML document in the world. Amongst those rules are that you can refer to things in all sorts of namespaces. In particular, the namespace that it uses here, it uses two of them. One of them is XSD, which is schema. Okay, so yes, if you were starting to get this image of this big snake rolling down the road with its, you know, with its tail in its mouth, okay, you're right. But it will make sense. It does make sense. Okay. Okay, we got to hurry. Let me just show you an example of validation. Is this big enough so you can see it? Yeah. So here's the validator. Are you allowed to watch this?
Yeah, anything that you
okay.
Okay.
You've got it in your handouts. You've got it in your. You've got it as source. It's pretty straightforward. It's at least idioms that you'll get used to. So it's the factory pattern. You're familiar with that, I presume.
What's the name of this file?
Sax validator 2. So it uses the factory, which is how this stuff works. It looks at the argument. You pass in a couple of arguments. If you pass in XSD, it validates it by schema. If you pass in DTD, it validates your document using a DTD. And if you don't pass in anything, it doesn't validate it. It just checks the parsing, checks that it's okay. All right? Oddly enough, the parsers are extremely inconsistent in the way you set them to do different kinds of validation. Okay? So, for instance, this particular parser, you have to tell it that you want to use namespaces. And if you just set validating on, it does DTD validation. This is so inconsistent. Okay. So, as I was getting ready to come over here, I was sitting over in the bookstore next to some poor Chinese guy who he was trying to learn English. He was sitting at a table with a young woman who was teaching him English. And, you know, I just hear these little snatches of conversation as she'd say, "Oh, no, you never use the when you're talking about a big building." And he'd say, "Oh, so we go hospital." And she, "Oh, no, it's some of them you do. Let's see, hospital and, you know..." And it's just awful. It's just so bad. Well, this is exactly like that. You just have, there are just these incantations, and you just have to remember the incantations, okay? So find this code somewhere on the web and, you know, put it in your home directory and just use it. So before you get the parser from the factory, you have to tell the factory what kind of parser you want. You want a namespace aware parser and one that's going to do DTD validation. Okay? And then you have to set these properties, which, as I say, it's just plain gobbledygook. And I apologize, it's not true. Set validating, if you set these two things, then it will suddenly remember that it doesn't want to do DTD validation anymore. Now it wants to do schema validation. Okay? Whereas up here, if you just set validating true and don't set any of these crazy properties, then it will do validation by TDD. Okay? So let's have a look. So I've compiled this already. There it is, right? There. All right. So if I say okay, so validation is off, it's got good syntax. So this shouldn't work, right? Because I just busted the syntax. Okay, so validation is off, but it's still got, can't parse it. It's not legal XML. So let's fix that. On the other hand, well, so this says that the purchase order type is a sequence of ship to, bill to, comment, and items, right? Sequence means they come in order. What were they? Huh. I don't even see one in here. Yeah, where are they? Oh, all right, right. 1, 2, 3. Oh. Oops. Abort. So if I just take this to... What? Sorry. And put it down here. That should break it, right? Because it said they were in order. Okay, so it says that's not valid, right? That's all there is to it. It's somebody else's problem. One of the main points of XML is that the tools are there, right? Not only do you, not only do you not have to worry about the complexities of writing such a thing, but everybody else has used this so much that you can pretty much guarantee it doesn't have any bugs in it. Okay? That's the good news. Okay, quick, let's do lecture 4. The main thing to remember about lecture 4, or about project 4, is that it will work a lot better if you remember that this is supposed to be happening on two very, very distant computers. Okay? It all happens to run on your machine because otherwise, you know, you couldn't control it, right? It would be hard to manage. You'd have to go to Chicago to do the other. I heard this joke about Chicago the other day. So Chicago was started by a bunch of people who were from New York, and they thought, man, this cold and the, or no, the garbage and the crime is just great, but it's really not quite cold enough. So anyway, so it will help a lot. It will help a lot if you keep in mind that these two programs that happen to be running side by side they just happen to be running side by side. Okay, they can't actually talk to each other. There's a big long piece of wire in between them. All right. You happen to be running them side by side, but what you're trying to imagine is that you've got a situation where this back-end piece, the catalog servlet, where the front-end piece, the catalog servlet, the cart servlet, and the receipt servlet are someplace nearby, okay, because they have to be nearby. You want one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast because that's where your customers are. But the back-end, the purchasing web service, is far, far, far away. And there's only one. Okay? And the reason there's only one is because it has to be synchronized. You have to know whether you have exactly two of this item left or you have none of this item left. Okay? That's it. I'm going to walk down the hall slowly and then convene a section there. And we can talk a lot about Project 4. All right? Thanks. Have a good time.